This recording is a production of the Conservative Anabaptist Education Committee. This presentation was recorded at the Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute 2025, held at United Christian School in Napanee, Indiana, on February 28 and March 1, 2025.
Good afternoon, and welcome. We're going to go ahead and get started, and maybe we can get done a few minutes early. I'd like to begin by reading a few verses from Mark chapter 10, one of the few stories where Jesus interacts with children. I know you know this story, but I'm going to read these verses. And they brought young children to him that he should touch them, and his disciples rebuked those that brought them. But when Jesus saw it, he was much displeased and said unto them, "Suffer the little children to come unto me, for such, and forbid them not, for of such is the kingdom of God. Verily I say unto you, whosoever shall not receive the kingdom of God as a little child, he shall not enter therein." I'm sure we're convinced that Jesus did not sort out these little children. Here are the really cute ones, the sweet ones. Give them an extra blessing, an extra little squeeze. Here are the ones that are so hard to love. For us, we're not Jesus, but we want to be like Jesus. And we have to acknowledge that not all children are as lovable as others. Just need to be honest. But I'm impressed with this because Jesus was displeased with the attitude of these of his disciples and said, "Your priorities are not correct. You are valuing maybe the adults." And when they felt like Jesus wouldn't have interest or time for the children, he was displeased. To me, that is sobering. Is Jesus displeased with how I relate to people? Is he displeased with my attitudes toward certain children? So I just want to give that as an encouragement for all of us to pray for the love and the compassion of Christ that reaches out and embraces all children. And I know there's times we wish situations would just go away. Of course, we wish situations would just go away. But let's be the hands and feet of Jesus in those and think of the privilege it is to be the hands and feet of Jesus. He's not here to pick them up and bless them and put his hands on them and bless them. He's not here to do that, but you are. And so we're called to be those hands and feet in a meaningful way in the lives of these children. And so instead of seeing this as, "I wish these children would go away," to turn our hearts towards saying, "Let them come to me. Let them come to me. I want to help them. I want to be the hands and feet of Jesus." Now, I'm sure I'm going to mention this as we go along. I know there are times where the situation is beyond what can be worked with in the classroom. And so we can put guilt on ourselves and on our teachers that we just need to do this. This is a situation God allowed you to have in your classroom. And so you just need to embrace it. And there are obviously lines where, and times where we need to say, whether it's administration or school boards, and acknowledge this is beyond what is healthy for the child and is sustainable in the classroom. And again, we'll pick that up later, but right away, if you're thinking, well, then, you know, Jesus could obviously had a well of emotional ability and understanding that he could do this. We need to be his hands and feet in every case, every time. We have our limitations, and we need to acknowledge that. So as was mentioned, this will not just focus on dyslexia, although I would like to talk about it some. And then we're going to also, as we have time, move into other challenges that children face, maybe surrounding more trauma and children that come from hard places. And so it's not going to just stick quite as narrowly with dyslexia. But let's talk about the brain just a little bit first. Anybody know how many brain cells? You might have. Or you can take a guess. I do hope you have are willing to contribute here.
10 billion.
He says 10 billion.
20,000.
20,000. That's a pretty big difference. Approximately, and the fact is they changed this in the last, I'm not sure how many years, but not but so many, from 100 billion to maybe more like 80 billion. How many people in the world? 8 billion, so you have about how many times more brain cells than people in the world? Math?
10.
So, I like to say this with students when I talk about the brain. Just imagine, you know, I don't have any brain, and I do, I mean, I do have a brain, so there it is. But let's say I do not have a brain, and I want to make a brain from brain cells of other people. Imagine every single person in the world would need to give me 10. 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, and you, and you, and you, and you, and you, all over the world. How big would that pile be? Some students are like, oh. Other students are like, oh, yeah, that big. Size of your brain. Incredibly complex at a cellular level, tremendously small. Our brains are certainly the most complex of God's creation. And so doctors in the last years are certainly understanding more and more about the complexities of our brains, their structures, of their pathways of communication, and understanding more and more why we face some of the challenges we do. And yet, of course, there's so much that they don't know, and certainly so much that we don't know. But I just want to impress us with the complexity of our brains and realize that a lot of the challenges that we're facing in our schools have to do with this complexity and not just a choice of the students. So I would like to, right up front, encourage board members, especially here in administration, to study these things as well as you can, to try to understand, to do not just unload this, offload this onto your teachers, that, well, this is your responsibility to understand and navigate and decide a path forward. This does belong to the administration and the boards as we navigate these challenges. So let's talk about dyslexia a little bit, and I'm sure some of you have studied this. At a general statement, I think the word that is used some to describe dyslexia is simply that it is a neurobiological difference. Now, I want to be so careful how I say things here. Materials use many different kinds of words in describing this. Some will use the word disorder, that dyslexia is a disorder of the brain. And so if I happen to say that, I'm not wanting to say that unkindly. If I use the word normal, I do not mean that a person that is dyslexic is not normal. All right, but sometimes we use words in a comparative way. So if I happen to say the normal brain instead of the non-dyslexic brain, I'm not wanting to cause an offense at all. I just need words to make some comparisons. So I'm not going to use the word disorder as such. I don't know how you look at it, but I think increasingly it is looked at as different, certainly not dumb. I like words that compare or similar. It's not dumb, it is different. If we go back years and years ago before there was an understanding of a person that is dyslexic, the conclusion was what with these children? What was concluded 30 years ago, 50 years ago?
You're retarded.
Right. Maybe that strong, or they are not as intelligent, or they can't learn to read. And so, of course, one of the most famous would be Einstein. I guess he was dyslexic. That's what they would say anyhow. So in school, I'm sure his teachers never imagined he would be considered one day one of the greatest scientists. But he couldn't learn to read as they taught him with their methods. So the conclusion, here's how we teach how to read. He's not reading, so he's just not intelligent. And today I think We don't think that way. Hopefully we don't think that way. It is a different way of learning, not an intelligence issue. And there's some interesting writings way back in the 1800s of teachers saying, this person is bright, they are so intelligent, but they can't learn to read. And so there was that real puzzle as to what is going on here. This person was obviously ingenious in many ways, could maybe fix things, understand things, engage people well. Never would have guessed there was a problem. Get to school and suddenly, what's going on here? It just seems so incongruent. It just didn't make sense to what they observed in their personality and in their gifting overall. Well, I think today, again, we understand there is something different about how the brain is functioning. I want to just talk about that a little bit without going into the weeds too deeply because that's not overly helpful. But I think if we can at least understand that, that's going to help us at least accept it is different. It's not an intelligence question. It is different. How the dyslexic person, and I know the better way is to say a person who struggles with dyslexia, but again, I might happen to say it the wrong way, a person that is dyslexic, how they process sounds and reading is simply different. And so the more we can align our teaching with that way, the better chance we have. So whether you consider it a disorder as such, that's really not the issue. The issue is, can we learn to identify the problem, and can we teach in a way that aligns with how their brain functions and the pathways of their brain? Now, you probably know we have a left hemisphere. To you, it looks left, it's my right, and a left hemisphere. Two sides of our brain. There's a lot of things that are the same. The lobes, we have a frontal lobe, that's where we do our thinking. We have an occipital lobe, that's where we, anybody know? Most students don't believe this when I tell them, I convince them, but anybody know, what do you do with the back of your head?
Motor skills.
Oh, good try, when that would be down lower yet your cerebellum, but anyhow, doesn't matter. Yeah, you see with the back of your head. So you hit yourself in the ice, you see stars, you know, what's going on, right? Circuitry's a little messed up. So we have a lot of similarities from one side to the other, but there are certain skills and functions that are at least predominantly found in the one side. Now that gets argued some in terms of maybe less right brain, left brain emphasis than years ago from what I understand, but still I think generally it would be accepted that it is the left part of your brain that processes sound, letters, and can decode the whole reading, spelling world. It's somewhat left brain activity or propensity. So this is now a genetic, when we say it's neuro, that means brain, nerves. Genetic is obviously, or biological, it's genetics. And so most people that are dyslexic, this is not because of a traumatic experience or a lack of teaching or training, and now they are dyslexic. Although scientists would say that that can lead to a dyslexic or similar dyslexic problem. But at least as a general statement, dyslexia is a genetic tendency. In other words, that's one of the first questions that generally we would ask schools. Well, is dad dyslexic? What about uncle? What about grandpa? And if there is absolutely no trace of dyslexia in the family, it at least is less likely that that is really is the problem. Although that is not to say that if there's absolutely no trace that you can make at all, that for sure it is not dyslexia. I don't know that anybody would quite want to say that. But a high percent. So it is genetic. So now that means this is a structural issue of the brain. And it is a difference. I know, well, we're simplifying it, but it's basically a difference of the left hemisphere. So now brain imaging scans that they do today, that of course they couldn't do 100 years ago, they can hook people up and say, okay, so we can see what sites are activated in a brain scan. Oh, there is a difference. There's a distinct difference. The non-dyslexic brain, when they engage words, and so they're all hooked up here, this is being scanned, and they read words, there's certain parts that are activated and light up and pathways that are activated, particularly in what's called the parietal part of the brain, in this area, and the temporal, in this area, that are highly activated in the left hemisphere. a person that is dyslexic, it is vastly different. There's very little activity happening in the left part of the brain in those specific regions. More's happening in the right part of the brain that would not normally be the reading processing components of the brain, as well as using some of the frontal lobe, which would be more our thinking and executive orders. If you know anything about a frontal lobe, this is where we, this is really the real us, how we think. It's happening sort of right here. So it actually engages part of the frontal lobe and not engaging parts that would normally be used for processing. And so at some level, I think it would be fair to say that the dyslexic person is putting demands on parts of their brain that aren't really intended to be used for reading and decoding words. Now, in an evolutionary vocabulary, some would say, and of course we're not evolutionists, but some would say is that our brains weren't even made for reading. You know, like we weren't made for that. I don't know what they think we were made for, but not for reading. In other words, children grow up, they learn to talk just from, they learn to see automatically. Read, it's not so automatic. So there's certain parts of the brain, as they would say, that, oh, sure, it can learn to read, but that's not really how our brains evolved. But they are making an interesting observation in that maybe there's really no part of the brain that really easily picks up the work of decoding words and spelling. But for the dyslexic person, what is normally picks up that activity, the sounds, the decoding, the reading, the spelling, the part of the brain that usually takes over that work and is activated, if that wiring isn't there, there's actually a difference, anatomy difference, brain scans will show that, the white and gray matter, there's a structurally a difference. Well, now the brain seeks for another way to try to make sense of the demands that you're putting on this person. How do you think it makes a person feel?
Frustrated.
Stressed. Fatigue. You see that in dyslexic children if you don't understand what's happening, or in yourself if you have dyslexia. So we are, in a sense, we're trying to put demands on the brain and processes on the brain that are not congruent with the task. Hence the frustration. Are there any questions? I know I'm running over this pretty quickly, and it's no use to get lost in the weeds very long.
Okay.
Appreciate the complexity of reading. So for the non-dyslexic person, when they simply see a young child, they can pretty easily understand cat. It is cat. For the person with dyslexia, the greatest challenge is seeing those letters and associating letters with the sound. Simply making sense of that. Even being able to distinguish between k, a, t. Oh, there's three sounds. There is kind of a running together and a difficulty deciphering sound. So we call that decoding. Might say, well, they can say cat. Well, of course they can. I mean, what 2-3-year-old can't say many words, even complex words, but get them to put that into syllables and break that into individual sounds, they don't understand, that, right? They would say, what three sounds is in cat? They wouldn't be, oh, k, a, t. That's a skill they learn, which again is left hemisphere, at least propensity, that is a side that will pick that up and be able to handle seeing that and decoding. Making sense of these letters or symbols and connecting them to sound. But if that is not wired as the non-dyslexic brain, it just doesn't make sense. And now there's other parts of the brain that are kicking in trying to figure this out and are frustrated and is tiring. So just kind of getting down to bottom line, at least a simple statement would be that the decoding is where the problem is. Decoding this and even seeing it as you see it, or the non-dyslexic brain. There's all kinds of, again, I don't know how they really prove all of this, but there's simulations of what does it look like to a dyslexic person. It maybe is, maybe the words move more, or they wave a little bit, or they kind of break apart. That may vary from person to person. But there's at least reasons to believe that there's actually a visual difference as they see words to the non-dyslexic brain. And I don't know if any of you can say, yes, that is how it is. And again, I don't know that we can box this in too tightly, because we have definitely different experiences, different people. But I'm trying to help us appreciate that this is not just about this child trying a little harder, just working a little more, and just stop your attitude, brighten up, sit up, you're not that tired, I know you're not, and just kind of hammering and hammering them. And I think it gives us some sympathy as we think about the demands that are put on the child. I've said already, maybe it's sort of like habla español. ¿Quién habla español? ¿Sí? ¿Qué dice? James? Jorge? ¿Cómo dice? What are you saying? What the world? Well, maybe that's how it is. If I start speaking Spanish, if as bad as my Spanish is. See, if you know how to speak Spanish, I don't know how to speak it. But if you don't know how to speak, I can speak Spanish. It's kind of one of those people, you know? I'm not connecting. We're putting demands on your brain that I don't know what you mean. And so I think even more so with this, it is not just obviously a language thing, it is more the decoding question. But I think in some ways it's paralleling to try to teach them in a way. So if I try to teach you something in Spanish, you say, I can't connect these dots. So what do we do? Again, there's a range from seriously dyslexic to less. And there are children who maybe have a touch of dyslexia, or adults, and you learn to read fairly well. You still don't like reading in public. You don't like that pressure, but you're fine. Others, it seems like it's serious enough that this will, try as you will, this probably is not going to ever just fall into place. Any questions? Yes. It's the same thing, not understanding. So, and you encode, and you're right, it's the same problem as decoding. So now, we're working with these children, we say, cat, and the teacher, cat. I mean, how much simpler? It just doesn't make sense. That's three sounds. What symbols would represent those sounds? It's again the connection between the symbols and the sound. The sound is not the problem. It's not a hearing problem. I can say those words. But to put symbols down that meaningfully represent those sounds, whether I'm encoding or decoding, is going to be a difficulty. Now, there are other things, and again, not sure how to navigate this part, but just to remember, there are other things that maybe look like dyslexia, but that is not really the challenge that the student has. And again, research is going to tell you not all the same thing, but maybe a child that, and I don't know if I should use the word, has ADD or ADHD or trauma, could also have reading challenges that maybe look like dyslexia, but that really is not in a structural way, brain structural way, that really isn't, it's not the same. Am I making sense? So sometimes it might be, oh, well, this child struggles with reading. He actually put some things backward, which probably a lot of us do once in a while, right? And then, oh, we're sure it's dyslexia. And so we're not actually diagnosing the problem correctly. And so what we are doing then to help might not be really a fit to the need. So one possibility is to get an evaluation, although this is complex. Some people are using our public schools. They are equipped in ways that many of our schools are not. I know there's all these issues in the public schools, but when it comes to training in academics like this and evaluations, they often do have some help, and you can tap into that. So just suggesting that maybe you can check that. Now, they might not give you an actual plan as to how to move forward, but at least kind of zeroing in on this is dyslexia. Or no, it is not, maybe it's an eye problem, or maybe it's a hearing problem, or something that's not related that we can't even ever get our hands on, really. Now, we want to diagnose so that we're sure that what we're doing is a fit here. That can be very, very difficult, though. And so I know I'm kind of saying, let's get this, you know, we want an evaluation, but it's not always that simple that it comes back, oh, here's a path, here's, this will work. It's often more nebulous than that. Let's talk about a few programs that are used. Three, in fact, I talked to two teachers in the last week that are all, both of them are using all three programs. These are fairly aggressive teachers. All About Reading, how many are familiar with that term? All About Reading, okay, just a few. It's not nearly as popular, but it is for dyslexia. We use a Orton-Gillingham way of thinking about letters, etc. Barton, I'm sure you know that, okay, most would. And then Christian Lake, fairly recently, has come out with Phonics Foundations. Lyndon Hartman's here as a rep for Christian Lake. He would be a great person to talk to. I'm sure he has Phonics Foundations there, a display, to ask him about that. So what do those do differently than BSR or Learning to Read or Pathway or ABECA, first grade? Well, what it does is two things I would suggest. Number one, it uses more multi-sensory ways of introducing sounds. And so we have three ways that we learn, right? We learn visually, we learn auditorily, and we learn kinesthetically, which means doing. And so it seeks to introduce each sound and each concept in more ways. In fact, a Phonics Foundation, I think, would say six ways. Barton would do the same thing. Rather than just in a day's time, you learn seek, listen, cat, they say it a few times, they do it a few, they kind of got it. They're going to spend more time working with that concept so as to do two things. One is to engage the person's brain where they can make more sense of it. All right? So now we're kind of shifting the normal way of teaching, which is left hemisphere favors left hemisphere activation, to teaching in a way that pulls in more sensory opportunity and a better chance of them making sense of this now, rather than all the demands falling on those regions of the brain. Am I making sense? So it's using a broader approach. And secondly, at some level, there is a therapeutic part where, I think it's the right word to use, a therapeutic part where it actually helps to build the pathways that are in the non-dyslexic brain or are normally found in people's brains. Is that making sense? So in other words, by doing that, it's an effort to actually build the left hemisphere's ability to be able to handle sounds better. So I think it's both. It's a broader way of looking at every single concept, more manipulatives, breaking words apart in different ways beyond what most children are going to need, so that they have a better chance of making sense of this. But then there's also some structural change taking place, which hopefully is actually making it easier for them to understand sounds in what would be the non-dyslexic way. Are there questions about that? Some of this maybe we can pick up this evening in the round table. Yes?
Are there tests to test a child?
Okay, so that's a very good question. There really are no tests that I know of that you could say, I'm going to download this, I'm going to run this little test, and in 15 minutes, we're going to have this child diagnosed. It's more complex than that. Now, a big question that I would get, I work for Christian Lake as a rep, and a big question I get is, well, is it okay to use these programs even though we don't know what's going on? Well, who's to really say yes or no to that? I hope I'm saying this acceptably or correct. While Barton and Phonics Foundation and All About Reading are designed to specifically work with how the dyslexic brain works, any child that struggles with learning to read, phonics, spelling, decoding, encoding words will likely be helped. And so I do work with schools sometimes and say, well, we're not really sure if it's dyslexic. But we check the eyes. There's not a problem with the eyes as far as we can tell. We check the ears. There's no problem there. We're really not sure. So this seems like at least something to try. And I'm cautious to say, oh, yes, way to go, because it is designed for the dyslexic brain, a way of thinking. But I think people probably have found it to be helpful. And these are reasons they're struggling that we're not really sure. But it is slowing the process down. It is more multi-sensory, and it is effective, even though it might not be a perfect match But what else, what are the options? Are the questions. And so, must we know for sure? Must we get this diagnosed? Well, who wants to answer? That's up to you, you know. We have limited resources. So a simple test, a 10-minute, 15-minute test that anybody could administer, no, not that I know of. Yes?
Would you say that it seems like it's more prevalent or more diagnosed, or why do we see the rise?
You think there is a rise, you're saying?
I think so.
Do you think there's a rise in schools? Or did we just not know it 30 years ago?
That's what, yeah.
Mass started teaching in 89. That's a few years ago. I didn't hear about this nearly as much as I do today. In part, it's because of what my work is today. Is it awareness? How many men say, well, yeah, when I went to school, we just got drugged through school, and now I realize that's what it is. So maybe I would suggest it's both. It's awareness, but seemingly also there's more cases. But if it's genetics, how much does that make sense? Or are there other things? See, I would suggest it's also that. There's other things that could look like dyslexia, but it's not necessarily for the same genetic reasons as a true dyslexic child. Does that answer your question?
Sure.
I mean,
yeah.
I can't really answer it
yeah.
conclusively, but that's what I'd suggest.
I was wondering what your opinion is.
Yes, that's a thought.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Kind of surrounding that part? Yes.
You said something about the public has a better way of, I just wondered, how do they check mm-hmm. in their face? Like
yeah, that's a good question. So there's evaluators in our Anabaptist circles who can certainly do that. But where are they? I mean, I know I have a list of people that I recommend, but maybe you're in a different state, or you know, this is hours away. And so they would simply go through all kinds of reading exercises to try to evaluate whether is this a dyslexic issue and ask questions from obviously the genetic question, like is this in the family, and in working with that child come to at least a reasonable conclusion that we think this challenge is dyslexia. But an untrained person cannot just do a little test and oh, we got this figured out. And please don't think as soon as a student switches something around that can be a symptom, but it's not the kind of like oh, he switches his, look at how he writes his letters, you know, he writes things backwards, so we're sure we got this figured out. It's something to observe, but don't build too much around one thing. That's what I'd suggest. Yes?
I guess I'm asking, from your perspective, your work in CLE, seeing lots of schools, you mentioned dyslexia, ADD, very briefly, trauma. Mm-hmm. Now, as a board, which question should we be asking? What are you seeing that... What are the possibilities?
We'll talk about this evening at a round table. But I will try to answer at least this. I think that maybe that one of the first questions I hear Peter Witt asking is there dyslexia in the family? You know, let's try to, if the issue seems to be the decoding and coding words, it's a reading issue here. At least starting with that. And actually maybe before that, was an eye test done? Was the ear test done to make sure it's not one of those issues? Because if that's the issue, and we're over here doing this program, we're actually not addressing the issue. Let me just talk briefly, and I do want to get to the trauma section here shortly. There are so many programs out there. Some of them are successful for certain students, and I'm a little concerned about this. We hear a great story that this program worked. And so we get on board with it, and maybe we should, but it didn't work so well after all. So how do we, I think my biggest caution is, especially as boards, but also as parents, that we don't hear one impressive story, how this just changed everything. I was talking to some people just the other day, and right away it's just, oh. And they're very excited in the school. They're working with a particular doctor on a particular method that's a little bit outside the box. And the whole classroom is engaged here. It's making a difference. And I'm not doubting it. But the next school down the road might hear the same thing and get on board, spend the money, get connected. And then a year later, 2 years later, oh, this actually isn't working out quite like we thought. So I'm not minimizing from Barton to brain therapy to neural feedback. and on, camp attached, that whole RADS world. But my burden is that we think carefully through it and we hold our hopes lightly. Does that make sense? Hold our hopes lightly, that this might be beneficial. Because many, many parents have been extremely disappointed that this did not turn out as they thought. So again, it's not to discourage evaluations, finding a way forward. Of course, we need to, but to at least hold our hopes lightly and not kind of like, oh, this we're sure is going to be, now we finally found the fix for this particular problem. Trauma, I'm going to just have to jump in here rather quickly, of course. I think trauma, we can think about it from two angles. It can be truly a brain development issue. So in utero, during pregnancy, if the mom is on drugs, doesn't want the baby, alcohol, it does certainly can affect and often does affect the brain structure. And we're not going to have time to go into this, but if you can just think real quickly, if we have 80 billion brain cells, I think a certain part during the pregnancy, I think it's 125,000 brain cells are being born every minute. They need to move away from what's called the neural tube and migrate away from there, which is a distance like from here to Chicago. Well, see, we're in the east. I mean, we're halfway there already. All right, here to California, wherever you want to go. An incredible distance, size-wise. It needs to migrate away, take up residency, and then become that type of brain cell, which is many, many kinds. If it's in the frontal lobe, it's going to become a thinking. It's going to send pathways, axons to other parts of the brain that it needs to go to. If it's in the back, oh, I'm a seeing neuron. This is incredibly complex, of course. But it just helps us appreciate how quickly that development can be disrupted. And therefore, this 6, 7, 8-year-old, structurally, there's actually a difference in their brain structure than would be outside of that. So that's one reason, can be because of brain development during pregnancy. There can also be, of course, trauma that the child experienced that also changed brain chemistry. And those can be things that nobody caused. It could be a death in the family. It could be an accident. It could be a hospital experience. So this isn't necessarily as the brain was developing in utero, not still not a fully developed brain, I realize, but it could be a traumatic experience that happened later, after birth, that altered how the brain functions. Or it could be abuse or neglect. And just thinking briefly of those, abuse tells a child, I don't like you. Neglect tells a child, you don't exist. And research has showed that neglect often has greater consequences than abuse. If you think of the ramifications of this, and maybe people you've worked with, neglect is just a huge, huge thing. And it changes how the brain functions. Especially neglect where a child did not have their needs met. Now it's me against the world. Have you seen students that are always on the alert? They're looking, they're checking, what's going on? You want them to focus. But their brains are set up to, I gotta take care of myself. And we can tell them all we want, that all the food they'll ever want is in the refrigerator. They still might hide it under the bed. Hoarding, we call it, right? Or you're safe, you're loved, but they don't know. They don't even know what that means. See, they don't know what that means. I think that impresses me more all the time. Let me just put something else here on the board, because, okay. So two ways of looking at these children, now again, kind of on the trauma side of things. Two ways is looking at, hey, children would do well if they want to. It's one way of looking at these children. Or children will do well if they can. This is academically and behaviorally. What happens if this is the only way we're looking at these children? Well, they'll do well if they want to.
We create pressure.
Whose problem is it? The teachers or the child's? Whose problem is it if we have this as the model?
Child.
the child. And so the goal now is to make them hurt enough that they change their mind and they decide they want to be a good little boy and girl because they don't want to be. And so now we tend to think in terms of punishment and consequences that got to hurt enough to make them change their mind. Do you really think that a third grader, fourth grader comes to school and he wants to just be a brat? So he wants to be. He's just a rebel. He just wants to come to school and end up in the principal's office one more time. He just wants to be ugly to the other students. He wants to be dysregulated and have meltdowns, etc., etc. See, if we believe that, and this is our model, then we think down in terms of punishments and we say this, well, one day he'll connect the dots. And my question, are you sure there's dots to connect? Are you sure? 20 spankings didn't work, but 30 will. He'll connect the dots one day. Got to hurt enough, and he says, enough of this. I don't want one more of those spankings. I won't lie again. The other way of thinking, children will do well if they can. Now where's the pressure? On the teacher or on the child? It shifts it, doesn't it? It shifts it at some level to the teacher. Now it is on the board and on the teachers, and I don't want to go too far down the path on teachers because this is not the environment here or the setting. But it becomes incumbent on the teachers and on the board and administration to say, how can we structure our classroom or this child's situation where they have a chance at making good choices? It's maybe a focus more on discipleship and mentoring than it is on discipline and punishment to change their minds. I really think some of these children come to school and deep down inside, they wonder what's wrong. They wonder how everybody else can just get through school so well, and they just can't quite figure it out. And to me, that helps to change our hearts toward sympathy and finding ways to help these children academically and emotionally, because we realize some of this is on us and it's not just on the teacher. I'm going to just really quickly, I'm going to try to unemotionally do this. I'm just going to take a minute to do this. To just give one experience in our family's life that was, I think in some ways I could say was trauma. About 14 years ago, we lost a son. Crib death, 3 months old. After praying for years for our sixth baby, 5 years later, we had our miracle baby. We was the happiest family in town. I was teaching school, 3 boys, 3 girls, I mean, wow. We weren't rich, but we were happy. 3 months, we found him, he was gone. A year and a half later, God gave us another boy. What do you think happened at night when I or my wife would wake up? We'd listen, is he breathing? And barrel out of bed night after night and go over and check. And, oh, yeah, he's still breathing. Go back to bed. And then the next night. If you would have told me, just get over it. Just get over it. I mean, come on, you're 40. Don't you believe in God? Have faith, trust. Wouldn't have been helpful. I'm sharing that just to help us think about how trauma even affects us, and I'm sure some of you experienced other things that you can connect some things here. Let's not reduce this to these dear children who face trauma, whether it's death in the family or abuse or you know in some of the situations in your school. Incredible pain and trauma. Let's not reduce it to, oh, they just got to change their mind. Oh, they are rebellious sometimes. They sure are. But don't reduce it to that and unload everything on them. Please don't unload it all on your teachers either. We have teachers quitting, don't we, because of this. Boards, I know you don't know what to do. Who does? Nobody has answers that, oh, here's what to do, this will fix the problem. This is not fixing problems, this is finding a way forward for the next day and the next day. And so I just want to encourage you as boards, get in there, learn, study, ask questions, support your teachers, help them create environments where at least we're giving them the best chance to be successful academically, spiritually, and emotionally. Help the teachers create safe environments. Help them know what are not safe environments to these children. It's a pretty calm, methodical school. It really is. The teachers who are flamboyant and got all kinds of fun stuff going and surprise days and balloon days, it just doesn't work. These children unravel. They can't come tomorrow and do well if they want to. They can't do well under that stimuli and uncertainty and fears. Help them to know how to be in control. I read one place that the best teachers in these situations are authoritative teachers. Now, doesn't that fly in the face of modern thinking that's creeping right into our schools? No. These teachers must be authoritative. They know how to be in control. These children manipulate and manipulate through anger, through all kinds of things. The teacher keeps being controlled by these children. Help your teachers realize you're in control. Here are the rules. These children fight the very thing that they long for, a sense of security and a sense of authority over them. They fight it, and we buckle so often to it. So help your teachers know how to draw those lines so we can create an environment that they can. At least it's our best shot at they can. Again, some of this we'll try to flesh out just a little more. Be careful, boards, as you are a team player, we tend to seek blame. It's the parents, it's the teachers. So, yes, there's needs in teachers. Yes, there's needs in parents. Yes, sometimes it's obvious that the parents aren't doing what they should to understand their child or do not have the home structure and on and on. And there's teachers sometimes that are really doing poorly. But when it comes to the blame, do you understand what I'm saying? There's nothing more than a need for a team where we can sit down together as boards, administrators, teachers, and parents and work through these issues and just talk them out and come up with a way forward. Please don't walk away from your teachers and just say, well, hey, God bless you. I'll pray for you tonight. I hope you figure something out till tomorrow. That's tough. Glad I'm not teaching. You must find a way forward that we all agree for the next day. And maybe it'll have to be tweaked in a day or two again. We are losing teachers in some of our schools. You know that. Maybe you have. Because they just are burned out. And so much rests on them. Another thing to be careful with is that teachers don't become burdened with this one child and neglect the rest. You'll lose support in your school because their hearts just go to this dear child and I'm just getting sucked into this over and over again. When really, all these children have needs as well. And so sometimes it's not sustainable to have the child in the classroom. It's not good for the child. The stimuli is too high. They can't really do well in this environment. And the teacher can't function well either because too much is going here and she herself doesn't have the emotional energy to care for others. Again, things that I'd be happy to hear your thoughts and questions this evening if you choose to come to that to just look at more practical examples. I'm going to, in closing, just mention Jeff Cooley is here in one of the rooms, I'm not sure which one, but you'll find him, with Bridge Builders. How many heard of that name before? Bridge Builders? Okay, just a few. So after many years of thinking and praying, a group of men under direction from different people, there is an organization called Bridge Builders. It is an effort to help schools, particularly with these trauma questions, helping parents, helping teachers, helping boards, just more from a maybe consultant standpoint. And so he is a rep for that. There's some brochures that you could take with you. It just kind of explains the vision behind it. It is certainly not a group of men who say, we've got the answers. If you find anybody like that, you probably don't want to talk to them. But is a group of men that care about this. And the goal is to be able to, from more of a third party, less emotion, a little more of a distant perspective, into needs. And so there's work done just directly with the community, directly with the school, whether that's phone calls or two or three people on those teams meeting right with the schools to kind of navigate our way through those things. Thank you for your attention, and you're dismissed.